Welcome to Making a Meal of It, the podcast for eaters of all appetites who want to reimagine and reinvigorate their relationships with food, food culture, and food systems. I am the digitally recorded voice that animates and edits this audio content, David Santo, a carbon-based life form. Today's show, as you might now suspect, is about media and digital technology, also artificial intelligence, and a few related divergences into food porn, celebrity chefs, sensors, and of course, science fiction. We're also actually going to be talking about eating. But first, does anybody out there remember this particular sound? Was the sound of enforced patience, of waiting, of anticipation, and maybe even a kind of sense of hope. But while the digital tones of a modem giving us dial-up access to the internet may now be mostly a meme about what slowness and kludgy technology, back in the 80s and even in the early 90s, it signaled that we were kind of going into another realm. It marked a sort of transition between the analog world and the digital one. It was a threshold to cross, at least mentally, and it made us realize that we were going into another kind of space, one that was both real and not real at the same time. Today, given how many of us spend so much of our lives both at work and at play in some form of connection to the internet, that threshold has become so blurry that it barely registers as a divider at all. Whether it's tapping a phone icon to see whether it's raining or sunny, instead of actually looking out our oh-so-analog window and, heaven forbid, actually stepping outside for a moment, or whether it's collaborating in real time on a coding project via GitHub, the line between virtual and actual is just ceasing to be meaningful in some ways. The Internet of Things, ubiquitous computing, all of our so-called smart devices, they all mean that there's just very little difference between that and this. Think of how hard it is to spend a truly unplugged weekend somewhere. Wires and wirelessness are everywhere. And one concern that a lot of people in the food world are talking about is this issue of what's called de-skilling. It's the process that happens when subsequent generations don't learn basic practices of humanity, those that, you know, used to be passed on to us by our grandparents or our parents or even our friends. Now, as our digital devices are able to do so much for us, the need to fend for ourselves has gotten less and less. And whether it's baking or finding food, reading a map, doing basic math, even keeping track of our daily appointments, so much has been automated and gamified that we're slowly, and sometimes quickly, turning into the human survivors from that movie Wall-E. We're really good at shopping and making digital content, but left in the woods on our own for 24 hours... most of us wouldn't emerge alive. So, while this may seem a bit melodramatic, the same shifts that have been replacing human know-how with algorithms are also having radical effects on the ways we perceive and relate to food. From what the explosion in screen-based food entertainment, what we used to call food TV, to the incursions of for-profit data miners and artificial intelligence companies into agriculture and fisheries and food delivery services, the mediatization and digitization of food is fully upon us. So what does that mean about our food culture? What does that mean about us as eaters? What does it mean when our fundamental relationship with ourselves and the natural world is now mediated by the code of programmers and tech industrialists? Some of the effects are already here. Some are still on the fast approaching horizon. My worry is that de-skilling is going to be one of the least problematic of those effects. I mean, we'll see, as I often say, we'll see, both ironically and with occasional glimmers of optimism. Trying to be positive about things, my first conversation is about the evolution of food media from early TV shows up to the TikTok culinary scene. I also dive into the technological developments happening in large-scale and small-scale farming and how early science fiction authors got some of the future right and some of it wrong. Maxime and I gag on a kind of digitized food thing during the Stick This In Your Mouth segment. And closing the episode, we find out how AI thinks about food during the food questionnaire. And I also have a little story about a very prescient sci-fi writer who was thinking about lab-grown meat and a bunch of other things way back in the 1950s. Kicking things off, we have Dr. Sina Russo, a professor of digital literacy at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. Sina did her PhD research on the rise of celebrity chefs way before what we call food media was a phrase that anyone was taking seriously. She's the co-chair of Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies, and author of the books Food Media, Celebrity Chefs and the Politics of Everyday Interference, and Food and Social Media, You Are What You Tweet. Sina, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. You've been working and writing about food and media for many, many years, food TV and celebrity chefs and celebrity in general. I'm curious to know, over the time that you have been working in this field, what you've been observing as major changes in the food media landscape.
Thank you for quite a loaded question.
Yes.
I have been writing about food media and food TV. Well, not from its inception, but maybe from a kind of collision of a certain kind of celebrity with particularly social media and more people having access to things. So while there were famous people on TV from, you know, before 1950, when I started noticing Jamie Oliver, let's say, as the kind of prototype for the work that I was doing, because my work was never about Jamie Oliver, but he was a very good example of something I found very strange, to see him behaving like a rock star on stage and his fans treating him like that.
Yeah.
And I think really the expanse of media reach, which comes with the challenge to our attention, was a very special moment in the early 90s or mid 90s when I started paying attention to that. And then the question of what sorts of changes I've seen since then is difficult to answer because it's been so explosive, I think, as everyone knows, with media tentacles growing everywhere. And once social media came on the scene, the same thing, apps come and go. And these days, I hardly watch food TV anymore. I used to enjoy it in the beginning. I mean, I felt very proud of myself that I had found like a great topic that I actually enjoyed researching. So I could spend a whole afternoon watching food TV, and it was interesting and new. And for the last week or so, I've been kind of tuning in, looking for something interesting. And a lot of it is, I find, extremely boring.
There was that explosion of food TV. We used to call it food TV. Now we call it sort of food media or digital content or all these other things. But there was so much stuff coming very suddenly after a relatively sort of educational but thin period of cooking shows where we were learning how to cook on TV. And then these shows started diversifying away from cooking. And now we're in some other weird tsunami of content that is, as you say, not that interesting sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that when I was working on my PhD, which eventually morphed into my book on food media, the one interesting thing that I saw changing from the kind of explosion of attention to someone like Jamie Oliver was also a kind of expertise creep, right? So after he had kind of established himself as the Naked Chef and then had started doing work on school food in Britain, then there was, I think, a temptation for him to imagine that now he was an expert on childhood nutrition. Mm. And so he tried to take his one show to America and go into kitchens and schools and reform the whole thing. And they didn't want to let him in. And he was quite perplexed by that because all he had gotten were eyeballs and attention and adoration. And he had gotten the UK government to pledge millions of pounds to improving school food. And there was a great moment in his, it was in Los Angeles. And it was all filmed, of course, where he was asking why he couldn't get into the kitchens. And they said, well, we'd love you to come and help us. And we value your willingness, I suppose, to come and share what you know. But we don't want your cameras. And so you can come in without the cameras. And that was like a slap in his face after 5 or 6 years of being just adored.
Yeah. And if the camera's not on, is it really happening?
Exactly. If you don't Insta it, then it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And there was also a very interesting moment in that series when he is addressing a conference of nutritionists and people who worked in school kitchens and so on in Los Angeles. And he was asking for their help. And then the floor opened for questions and someone just stood up and said, you're addressing a room of maybe 400 or 500 people who do this for a living. Can you just tell us why we should listen to you? And he was completely flummoxed.
Do you think now that celebrity or fame, or at least recognition, followers in the digital era, which is what we would have called fans in the old pre-digital era, in this era, whatever we're going to call it, in the very fast digital media era, sort of post-YouTube into TikTok, into the very quick fabrication of notoriety or visibility or fan bases or followings, have things started to shift in terms of what celebrities, food celebrities, are recognized for or given the capacity to speak to?
Well, that's also a very good question, which my own expertise is now limited by the fact that I do often find it quite tedious to try to catch up, and because there is so much going on all over the place, and then there's a new platform and then it fades away. I mean, people were doing Snapchat and next we're doing TikTok, and now we're talking about privacy, some people being nervous of having TikTok on your phone. So all of these sort of developments, the longevity of platforms, the kind of meta or external issues like privacy, global politics, kind of feed into that. And for myself, I can say probably Instagram becomes kind of interesting, I think, for a very direct, raw kind of exposure, because people can, I understand that people are doing this on TikTok also. But I'm thinking of a chef like José Andrés, who is a Spanish chef who's based in DC. He's been there for about 20 years, but last year finally became a US citizen. And he also has an organization called the World Central Kitchen. And whenever there is a crisis, or at least the ones in recent memory for me, so Ukraine, also now Gaza, Israel, he mobilizes his team and they go and they try to get food to people. He doesn't talk about how good it would be to mobilize. He doesn't get on TV and ask for donations. He gets out there and he does it. And he films himself and shares it. And it's kind of amazing. He's also got one of the most coveted restaurants in DC. It's called Mini Bar. I think there are like 8 seats. It's very expensive. It's very exclusive. But he is also very much on the ground.
And so he's become, instead of a celebrity chef, he's an activist chef. He is a celebrity. He's well known, or he is celebrated, but he's also using his power for good.
Yes, absolutely. If we go back to one of the shifts I was describing, when Jamie Oliver went into sort of childhood nutrition, I think that was also a moment of activism, but it was one that was not authorized because he was going into actually a scientific field that he had no right to be in. But going out and feeding people is not something you need a degree in. And by the way, since I wrote about Jamie Oliver now many years ago, he has actually got a master's in nutrition.
Oh,
so he's got more than he did in terms of the expertise when I was writing about it.
Well, so then that's sort of interesting, because I would imagine that his desire to go back and get a degree might have been, in fact, a reaction to what he witnessed as non-acceptance of that expertise. And so he just said, well, if I want to do this, which indicates a goodwill, then I better learn about it.
Absolutely. And kudos to that.
Yeah. We did used to worship our food TV hosts and cooks. There was so much adulation for their artistry, their creativity, their charisma. And I'm wondering, with the digitization of media, with the accessibility, and with more and more consciousness about what food systems are and how they're difficult and challenging, and what some of the social issues are beyond the pleasure of eating on the table, which is, of course, an important part of food, but not the only part of food. Do you think that there's a new future for what well-known people, and I won't even use the word celebrity, but well-known people who've got followings and influence and agency, do you think that there's a new role for them in food activism or food media or food anything?
That's also a very big question, David. I'd like to start by asking you, if you don't mind, what exactly you mean by digitization?
So when I say digitization of media, I'm thinking about, because I also was a teenager in the 1980s and lived in a world where my media came through an analog signal on radio frequency to my television set. My options were to change the channel and change the volume. And since that time, when I was watching early food television shows where a chef would appear and then there was a commercial break and we come back after the commercial and something had been cooked miraculously in the last 2.5 minutes, this was the era of television, food TV that I grew up with. And there was some magic in it. I was even on a food TV show at the age of 11 and, you know, learned a little bit about what goes into the sausage of food television. And so I grew up with this sense of, okay, I know what food TV is. And then the internet, and then all of the applications, and then all of the diversification. So I guess when I say digitization, I mean everything that has changed since I was a child, or since I was a teenager and loving food TV, or loving food magazines, which were also very analog for me. I was not reading them online. I was getting a subscription to Gourmet Magazine that came in the mail. So that was my original history with food media. Now I see multiple channels, not just TV channels, but channels of information, ways to get things before my eyes or into my ears. Food podcasts, for example, but also all of the different algorithms that are pushing information to me for me to make choices about what to look at and what not to look at. It's just this incredible diversification facilitated by the internet and the capacity to make relatively high quality content pretty well anywhere and by anybody who's got a few editing skills and a bit of personality. And so that's what I mean by digitization. That's what's everything. And it's very personal because it's everything that's changed in my lifetime.
No, absolutely. Thank you for what you're describing is what some people have called, you know, push versus pull media. It has become enormous. And I do want to stress, I don't think it's all bad. I think there are many things that are fantastic about it. I think that it's a platform that can be used for enormous good. And also, look, there was something we saw during COVID, for example, when suddenly people couldn't be physically together. And there was an option to have a meal with a family member or friends who weren't physically present. And you could just set up your iPad and cook together, whether it's FaceTime or, you know, Zoom or MS Teams or whatever it is. And that's a wonderful sort of opportunity to connect. And also someone, just to go back to the example I used earlier of José Andrés and the kind of humanitarian work he does in areas where there are crises, it's amazing to be able to follow that so closely, so rapidly, so freshly. And it's something that I'm very grateful for. And you mentioned earlier how one evolution that you have noticed is also about things becoming more about food systems and so on. I'm sure we will talk a little bit about how food studies has become more interesting and more mature about things like food systems and global politics and supply chains and things like that. Spectacle and shock has become boring, which is quite a sad thing to say.
Yeah.
But I'm sure I'm not the only one who thinks so. Just to mention another example of someone who was outlandish or has been outlandish for most of his career in the kind of food media world would be Heston Blumenthal, the chef of the much acclaimed Fat Duck restaurant in Bray in the UK. And Heston Blumenthal was the only one I could write about who had a TV show where he explicitly said to viewers, please don't try this at home. Because it was so fantastical.
Yeah.
It wasn't about teaching anyone how to roast pork or potatoes or whatever. It was about Willy Wonka's fairy tale down the rabbit hole, and people could lick the walls and have 5 different flavors. And that was fun while it lasted.
Yeah. Well, and it was a show. He put on a good show, and he wasn't trying to do something else. It wasn't in the guise of X or Y or Z. It was just, this is great TV.
And one of my all-time favorites, I won't miss an opportunity to talk about Keith Floyd, one of the early pioneers of British food TV, at least. What was so amazing about Keith Floyd was that he kept drawing attention to the artifice of what he was doing. So he would be cooking something and he'd say to his cameraman, I believe his name was Clive, he'd say, Clive, get in here, get the camera in close. And the camera would steam up. But he was always reminding his audience that they were watching something that was being filmed. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he would mess up. And then he would just, in his cheery way, kind of say, oh, well, these things happen, and let's have a slurp and cheers.
I think what you just described about drawing attention to the apparatus of media making is also what food studies is starting to do, is drawing attention to the apparatus of food knowledge making or food research making, or that it's not neutral when we intervene as researchers or as media makers or as anyone. And so that some of that reflexivity and self-awareness is what's starting to come in. And that's, I mean, that's also a shift in the way anthropology has been thinking about itself for the last few decades, is this shift towards reflexivity and how doing research is also creating something. It's not neutral. And I wonder if that's something that we might hope for more with food media, that food media and food studies can learn from each other in some ways about putting on display the sausage making apparatus, as it were, how things get made has an effect on what that thing becomes.
Well, what you've described about food studies there and that kind of evolution is absolutely true. I think, I mean, even before I started looking specifically at food media, my master's was in film studies, and I became very interested in the spectacle and the fact that there is no spectacle without spectators.
Right.
You know, it's all back to this idea of critics in the 70s pointing out that the product of TV are the consumers, because we are watching, and without the eyeballs, there is nothing.
Right. We are creating it, and it creates us, and there's this dynamic.
Yes, gosh, and that makes us sound like strange kind of AI sci-fi TV show, which is probably coming to your screen
any day now. With food. Do you have any thoughts or feelings or concerns about AI and food?
Well, when you mention AI and food, the first thing I do think about is sort of stories about robots making ramen in Japan or South Korea or something like that, which I also don't find that interesting. But otherwise, having also written extensively about what is known as food porn, I can't help but to go to the kind of version of what people consume, whether it's pornography or food media, that might just involve fewer people. I'm not entirely sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Once again, if it means there is less harm, then I'm all for it. It's evolving so fast. I mean, when did we start talking about ChatGPT? It was at the beginning of 2023 or at the end of 2022. And now it's, you know, it's the norm. And it's kind of impossible to predict what's going to happen. I think I reached a point a few years ago where I understood that it was impossible to keep up with everything to the point where I could be making conclusions. In preparing for this podcast, I was remembering that my book on food and social media, which was published in 2012, was reviewed in Gastronomica, which I am now on the editorial board for.
Yes, yeah.
It was reviewed in 2014. So this is 2 years after it came out. And it was a fairly positive review. But the main problem that the reviewer found was that the book did not consider Instagram, which was by then the leading kind of platform.
Right.
But Instagram only became available, at least to Android users like myself, about 2 months after my book was published. So it was like, well, I would have loved to include Instagram, but it wasn't there yet. And in 2 years, it became so ubiquitous and so kind of normal that it became a glaring omission in something that was trying to track a kind of evolution of these social media platforms and how they related to food.
And now it would be nearly impossible to write a book that would be current at the time of its publication. You'd have to, well, it has to be then a digital publication that can be updated in real time, which is another...
Well, ChatGPT could write the book in about an hour.
That's what I should be doing. I'm going to go ask ChatGPT what it thinks the future of food and AI is. I'll get back to you.
Maybe you should.
I will.
It would be an interesting footnote to this conversation.
Yeah. Well, this conversation has been absolutely delightful and fascinating. I'm so grateful for your time and your insights. And thank you very much for being part of the show.
Thank you so much, David.
To read more about Sina Russo and find links to her books and other projects, be sure to check out the show notes for this episode on your podcasting platform or at makingamealofit.com. You'll also find some responses that I got from ChatGPT about its views on how artificial intelligence might have impacts on the future of food. My thanks to Sina for that suggestion. Next up is my conversation with Maz Gardezi, a faculty member in the Department of Sociology at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia. His research looks at two issues that are common to both the U.S. and South Asia: climate change, adaptation and mitigation, and the social implications of emerging digital technologies in agriculture. He's also a pretty thoughtful science fiction imagineer and made me promise we'd chat about both speculation and actuality when it comes to digital futures. Maz, thank you so much for being here on the podcast. It's really a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
So your work is largely about the social and political implications of using digital technologies in food and agriculture. Can you give us an overview of what that actually means?
Absolutely. So we have seen in the last couple of decades a proliferation of these new technologies that have come up in food and agriculture systems, whether it's through artificial intelligence, big data, sensors that are in the soil, or some of them are in low orbit around the Earth. And one of the things that I'm really particularly interested in is how a profession such as agriculture, which is one of the oldest professions for us as a civilization, how does it interact with these new and emerging technologies in ways in which it allows farmers to make decisions about some of very challenging issues that they're facing, including climate change, other types of risks, whether it's diseases or whether it's just issues around water quality in terms of, you know, pollution that comes out of the farm. So when I say the social and political implications of digital agriculture, what comes to my mind is how we could rethink the ways in which technologies are developed for farmers, but also in general to be used in rural communities in ways that can serve a larger objective. So it's not just for maximizing profits, but can also be used for minimizing environmental harms, for allowing people to, you know, do things that can give them some agency, whether it's a farm worker who's trying to achieve a specific goal, raise their family on the farm, or just thinking broadly about the implications that these technologies can have in helping us achieve the broader goals about being creative as part of humanity, about being able to help each other. And that's basically what social implications are.
Wow. Well, it seems like there are a lot of, I mean, I have a lot of questions, but it seems like there are a lot of places where technologies, particularly digital technologies, artificial intelligence, can be very productive at the very large scale of agricultural production in, you know, giant corporate farms and industrial food scale production. But I mean, you mentioned families taking care of each other and taking care of their kids and having a future and maybe being good shepherds for the earth. How do technologies play out at that smaller scale when it's not just about productivity, but about a much bigger set of environmental questions?
That's a great question. And unfortunately, I feel that a lot of the interest right now is not in that question, right? At least from the production side of things. Food and agriculture technologies currently are being driven by the demand for or meeting the demand for large-scale producers, as you just described, and especially those that have the ability to buy, you know, expensive machinery or are already wealthy, already educated to some extent, can make sense out of data or can change their practices or have the ability to do that. But I think there has been some ways in which we've started to think about how these digital technologies in food and agriculture can also work for small-scale farms. Just to give you some examples, there's been a lot of emphasis on using cell phones to provide information services. So having information, whether it's information about crop insurance, weather advisory, it can also be advisory in general, like for in terms of how do you grow crops. So there's been a lot of emphasis on information services at the early half of the 2000s and then up until, you know, now.
So those would be pretty straightforward technologies for a farmer who doesn't have millions of dollars to invest in giant data packages or other really complicated technologies. Someone can afford a cell phone pretty easily and then have access to basic information, even in the field where they're doing their work.
Absolutely. But even there's some challenges with information technologies that can be as simple as providing cell phone services. And so like some of the research that I'm doing in Pakistan is basically saying that it's not such a great idea to provide individualized services to individual farmers, because a lot of decisions that are made about farming are made by the community or at the community level. So if you start providing individual farmers recommendations about what they should be doing on their farm, it's not going to be as meaningful.
much less of what we would call sort of a neoliberal approach where everyone's out for themselves and making change or taking action at an individual scale, but really trying to think about the larger picture of what it means to be a farmer within a community, within a region, not only producing food for that region, but taking care of the land at the regional scale.
Absolutely. But a lot of it has to do with this idea that still in a majority part of the world, the notion of private property doesn't exist. You know, you could give people cell phones and information from those cell phones, but if they're not able to make decisions on a particular piece of land because they don't particularly own it and it's just the community that owns it, then they just get to work on it. And those are some of the communities that I'm working with in Pakistan, in those remote mountain communities near Gilgit-Baltistan, in the specific province of Baltistan, where communities have been very resilient for over the last 500 years and without having the need for either ownership of land or water. And I think these kind of technologies wouldn't particularly work very well because they're so individualized and they're based on Western ideas of private property.
Right. So it's more farms that are more within the Western tradition of corporate and large scale agriculture where the really big, like big data technologies and artificial intelligence are probably being used.
Yeah. And, you know, there might be some other ways in which these technologies may work for farms that don't necessarily have private ownership or where the size is not too big. Certainly, there has been a lot of development of publicly accessible satellite image, either from the U.S. government point of view, the more recently from Chinese government, but the European Space Agency. The issue is that, again, like a lot of the image that you get from satellites don't necessarily have a very high spatial resolution. And so what happens in the end is that the size of the farm is so small that each pixel is, you know, still not large enough to give you specific information about a very small farm.
So satellite imagery might be better used at the very large scale of agriculture rather than by small scale production?
I mean, there's some ways around it. There's some development of low-cost drones that can be flown over small-scale farms, and that can help in kind of ground truthing some of that data that comes from the satellite. You can have sensors in the soil and water. A lot of cheap sensors are being developed. Again, the problem is that you can develop all these technologies, but if there is no infrastructure available in rural areas, either for internet connectivity or for the ability to transfer lots of data from the sensors to a cloud service, then it doesn't really make sense. So people have tried to come up with ways around it. There's some non-Bluetooth, non-internet connected sensors that can still give you some sense about, like, you know, how much soil moisture there is and what kind of nutrients there might be. But there's not a lot of development around those technologies because for obvious reasons, that's not where the market can make a lot of money.
Right. So the digital technology industries are really looking at big scale clients because that's where the big scale profits come in.
What I'm hearing from people that are developing agriculture technologies themselves, they are not so much interested in developing, you know, so-called decision support tools for small-scale farms. But what they're really interested in is using blockchain technologies for contracts. Blockchains can allow you to develop smart contracts that are easy for traceability.
Just to explain for listeners what blockchain technology is, as I understand it, I mean, it's part of the cryptocurrency concept. Now I think you're talking about it being used as a means to create traceability in terms of a history of exchanges, whether it's a contract or actually history of exchange of actual farmed products. Is that what you mean by blockchain technology?
Absolutely. So a history, a documented, a traceable, a somewhat transparent manner to understand how goods and services are exchanged. Mm-hmm. The promises of blockchain, at least from the technology development point of view, is that it reduces the need for the middleman or the middle person.
And that's one of the big problems for relatively small or medium scale producers, is that they often lose a lot of profit in having those middlemen involved.
Exactly. Exactly. So whether it's for coffee production or cocoa, or whether it's for cotton industry, a lot of the middle intermediaries are the ones that are kind of extracting a lot of profits.
Tell me, if you will, about artificial intelligence. This is heavily in the news in all sorts of spaces. We are both excited and terrified of what it may mean for the future. In terms of small, medium, even large-scale agriculture, what do you see as the implications for AI?
One of the things that I'm finding particularly interesting is that whether it's artificial intelligence or machine learning, is that a lot of the development of the models is focusing on very specific type of farming systems, very specific types of crops, not so much on food crops, and a lot more on commodity crops.
Commodity crops being things like cotton and wheat and rice and corn.
Particularly in the US, Midwestern US and Canada, and Mexico as well. And the challenge is, what can we learn from models that are trained on data from large-scale commodity crops when we apply these models to understand small-scale farms who are trying to do more, you know, biodiverse agriculture? What happens to these models? Do they work? If they don't, what do we need to make them work? So there's a lot of like tinkering that goes on in order to make them to work. Now that's a problem because a lot of the data and large amounts of data is generally collected from very large scale agriculture because that's where more data is available. And the reason why there's more data available is because, you know, those farmers have the money to go out and buy large equipment, and that equipment already has sensors built in. So there's a lot of data that is already being produced. But a lot of small farms and farmers don't have the ability to do that. So that is where I see the role of satellites to come in. One of the things that we're learning in our project, and that's kind of the holy grail right now in scientific research, especially around AI, is how do we develop algorithms that can allow us to make sense about what's happening on a small-scale farm by relying only on satellite imagery. Now, that's tricky to do because for a number of reasons. First, satellite imagery. Look at the two big programs. One is the US program called Landsat. It's a 30-meter resolution, so each pixel is 30 meter by 30 meter.
Okay, so that's not super high resolution.
That's not super high resolution. So that satellite will go over the same piece of land every 12 days. So it's low spatial resolution, but high temporal resolution data. But then you look at other free satellite imagery that's available through European Space Agency, and they go down to 10 meter resolution called Sentinel-1 and Sentinel-2. And then you can go to some commercial satellite programs. They're sub-meter resolution, right? So they're like 6-inch resolution. So each pixel is very, very, very high resolution. So if we can create conditions for governments to invest in more higher resolution data imagery that is available freely to the public, I think there is a way in which we may be able to compete with the machine learning models that are coming out of the private sector. So I see a lot of hope there, especially also when it comes to issues around drought and flood and early warning and early hazard systems. And so, you know, you can address a range of questions that private sector isn't typically interested in, which serve the public interest through more better use of satellites and then develop AI algorithms around it.
Let me turn to a more hopeful or at least maybe playful question for you. Science fiction authors have been, since the 1950s, coming up with some pretty amazing predictions and some scary ones too about the future of food. AI is in their technologies, both digital and non. But what do you think about the ways that science fiction has gotten things either right or wrong? Or what do you see as the future of food, or are we already in it?
So I think that's a great question. One of the things that I think sci-fi has got incorrect is it is very, very difficult to control and dominate nature through technology. I think it's easier to do that through politics, and we've seen that happening. You can make policies and you can control what kind of crops are grown and which ones aren't. But to be able to tame that process through technology has been very difficult. There is this idea that we've got to control it, right? And that there's no other way than just to be able to dominate it. And instead of like, how can we understand it better? Like sometimes I wonder is like, what if we put in all our energy, whether it's through the development of new technologies, whether it's through like the, you know, use of sensors, to be able to like get a better understanding about how nature works instead of trying to dominate it all the time.
Well, this is humanity's classic failure, thinking that we're better than nature in some way and that we're smarter or more powerful. It's the, you know, father science and mother nature duking it out, and mother nature always seems to come out on top.
Exactly, right? And so in terms of my own visions, I'm very optimistic about everything in general. and so I feel like sci-fi does have a role in kind of making us think about all the alternative futures that are possible.
It seems like, you know, it's the space of speculation and wonder and amazement and possibility versus the space of what is and what drags us down every day. It's that space of imagination that presumably the science fiction writers of the past were hoping might come about in the future, and maybe were trying to write it into some sort of reality, even though they didn't necessarily all succeed. But at the same time, what you describe is that there's lots of possible futures, and somewhere in there, there's a lot of hope.
Absolutely. There are lots of scenarios that one needs to explore. And especially for younger people who are just getting into high school or earlier, that still believe or want to believe that there is a future that they would like to live in, I think they have a big contribution to make. In one of our projects, we are working with the Science Museum in Roanoke, Virginia. And that museum specifically is focused on children between the first and the fifth grade, right? And so there's some ways in which Science Museum but other ways in which, like fiction is another, that we can start thinking more about alternative possibilities.
Well, I'm really happy that you are doing this kind of work, because it makes me feel a little bit of hope myself. And what you describe really seems to point towards some very complex, but very delicious and potentially very fair and just futures of food and technology and AI altogether. Thank you so much for being part of the show.
You're welcome. Thank you.
To find links about Maz's work, as well as some of the work going on in digital agriculture, precision ag, and the impact of big data research in food production, see the show notes for this episode wherever you listen. And we're back for another edition of Stick This In Your Mouth. Hello, Maxim.
Hi.
Are you ready to go digital with our food?
Digital? Oh, tell me more.
Okay, I will. So we've got some Soylent to taste this week.
What?
Well, not Soylent Green. Soylent Green is people, after all.
Thank God. No,
this is Soylent, the meal equivalent replacement substance that was developed out of Silicon Valley a bunch of years ago by coders who wanted to minimize the time they spent thinking about or even eating food.
Mm-hmm.
And so they developed, this was this product that was developed, basically a system of powders and oils and liquids that could be used to construct your perfectly balanced nutritional something or other, but without having to think about actual food.
Wow.
So it became a big thing.
Taking the joy out of eating. Yeah,
but taking the time out of eating. This was all about coders who wanted to spend all their time coding.
Oh, my God.
And not wasting time, in air quotes, on food.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very much a part of the digital world. But in some ways, it's also kind of like digitized food, I think. It's a bit like, you know, what we do to corn, wheat, and rice. We break it down into its component parts and then build it back up again in food factories to make highly processed foods. But in this case, they've just broken it down into components and they haven't built it back up. Anyway, it's got this long history. People were sort of testing it out as like a fun, weird thing to do with food. I had some friends who ate it, but had dinner parties where they served real food to their friends, but they ate Soylent because they had doing the Soylent experiment thing for a month. And the friends got really mad at them for kind of abstaining from regular food.
Well, I would be very mad.
But it was a project.
So, yeah, of course.
What they were trying to do is like say, okay, well, I'm going to eat this, you're going to eat that. Why not have it just be Soylent?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Soylent seems to have gone through some evolutionary phases. I have a friend who did some research on the community that developed around Soylent, because people were, despite the fact that it was meant to be sort of thought-free food, people mm-hmm. were developing recipes and sharing them with each other for ways to make it, I guess, more palatable or more interesting. I don't know. Anyway. So we're going to try some liquid Soylent strawberry flavor.
Mm.
Tasty. Serving it to you in an elegant shot glass.
Bottoms up.
Bottoms up. Here's to perfect food with no thought. Yeah. Okay. So it's like,
yeah.
What do you think?
Well, no different than any kind of meal replacement or even protein shakes.
I mean, you used to drink whey shakes.
Yeah, whey shakes and stuff like that.
So. Did you enjoy them?
No, never. Oh. I've never was able to find one flavor that was actually a real flavor and not highly chemical in taste. So no.
Yeah.
No, it's just...
Well, I think the original Soylent didn't have flavors, and then because that was so disagreeable to so many people that they started adding different flavors, mild flavors.
And in this particular case, the strawberry doesn't taste like any real strawberries.
No. What do you think about the idea of, you know, a meal in a bottle or a meal in a pill, all the sort of futuristic ideas that we once had about meal replacements?
I'm not opposed to it because I find that there are certain situations where you would actually, if let's say you're an astronaut and you're in space or you're an older person and you have trouble supplementing or you don't really have appetite, and these kind of products I find are a little easier for older people to ingest.
So are you looking forward to the time when you're an older person or perhaps an astronaut?
I will never be an astronaut, and I will be an older person, but am I looking forward to that? Not quite sure.
So this little taste of Soylent doesn't make you think, can't wait.
No. Absolutely not. But I could also, for people with very extremely busy lives who don't have time to sit down for a proper meal, and I hope it's exceptional and not every single day, because, you know, you should sit down and relax. I think it's important that we take time to eat and take time for ourselves, for the nourishment that it brings us, not just the physical nourishment, but the psychological nourishment.
Well, this is what I always think about when I make the comparison between this kind of beverage and digitized content.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the digital world has become very interesting because you can create almost anything, particularly now with generative AI. There's so much freedom to create worlds of imagination with, for example, graphic technology or sound or AI. Like, there's all this potential creativity because you've broken things down into ones and zeros, and then you can build them back up into any kind of image or any kind of sound or any kind of word. And yet, trying to do that in food seems really antithetical.
Absolutely.
And I don't quite know why I would be so opposed to doing that in food if I am relatively in favor of it in the information world.
Because I think the joy and the pleasure of eating food is the unusual combination sometimes.
So things that you can't just construct out of ones and zeros.
Exactly. Because sometimes you know... the recipe calls for one ingredient, which you don't have. You replace it with something else, and then ta-da, you have a surprise. You didn't expect it. It's delicious or not, but it's interesting, and you would not have discovered it otherwise.
Good point. And speaking of surprises, I just had a surprise. I just burped up some fake strawberry flavor into my mouth.
Thanks for sharing.
Always. Anything for you. As usual. Namaste, and thank you for joining me on Stick This in Your Mouth.
Au revoir.
Bye. About 15 years ago, I stumbled upon an old paperback copy of a science fiction novel called The Space Merchants. It was written in 1952, right at the dawn of the SF era, by the American authors Frederick Pohl and Cyril Kornbluth. Something about it grabbed my attention, probably the very campy cover image that looked both hopeful and terrifying. You know that old saying, don't judge a book by its cover? Yeah, it's wrong. Book covers often say a whole lot about what's going on the inside of them. And this book was certainly, well, maybe a little hopeful, but very definitely terrifying. The story focuses on a big corporate ad exec at the top of his career who's pitching for the government contract to market Mars. Yeah, it was a marketing campaign for a whole planet. At this point in Earth's history, the Terran surface is covered by cities and there's no farmland left. Urbanism and consumption have taken up almost all of human existence. And the most powerful entities on the planet are the ad agencies. And they're so powerful that each of them have employed private armies because they keep trying to assassinate each other's CEOs. I'm not making this up. Anyway, our hero quickly falls from grace, and after a bunch of adventures, he ends up on Mars, the planet he was hoping to market to new colonists, with the promise, basically, of space to live, freedom, and an overall better life, the usual promises that people are fed when trying to get them to radically uproot themselves. Anyway, it turns out that Mars is just like other colonies in the history of human existence, a place of suffering and exploitation where land and human bodies are used to farm agricultural commodities, all of which are aimed at feeding the food industry back on Earth. And what's the very basic commodity? Well, it's algae, grown by human slave labor in giant vertical farms. And then the food industry that the algae feeds back on Earth is a fleshy entity called Chicken Little. Effectively, it's a lab-grown biomass of simulated chicken meat that is harvested periodically to feed the middle classes who can't afford bird-grown meat. Yes, so some 70 years ago, Frederick Pohl and Cyril Kornbluth were already imagining that the future would include ongoing colonization of people and land, of slave labor in agricultural settings, of the hyper-urbanization and capitalism that would run rampant across the planet, and of stratified classes of meat consumers, where cell-cultured chicken was already a reality. It's too prescient. And when Maxime and I first tasted that first sip of Soylent during the Stick This In Your Mouth segment, I kind of felt I was a digital slave gagging down his daily ration. It echoed too strongly in this book for me. So there's little question that digital information systems and some kinds of automation and many types of technology have made human life easier, very often more interesting, and frequently very delicious. But at what cost are all these innovations coming? Are some of us benefiting a lot more than others? Yes. Is virtual food porn numbing us to the sensory realities of growing and cooking and sharing and tasting actual material real-time edibles? Absolutely. Is our collective culture suffering as more and more people rely on ready meals and food delivery apps, TikTok recipes, and gross out food hacks? I certainly think so. I mean, I'm all in favor of evolving and growing and discovering new things and new ways to eat, but I am really worried about food getting so streamlined and digitized that we somehow get used to ingesting, I don't know, algorithms. Closing out this making a meal of it buffet is, as usual, the food questionnaire. What's not so usual is my respondent this week. After having followed Sina Rusto's suggestion to ask ChatGPT about how AI might affect foodways in the future, I also turned to the bot with my food questionnaire questions. And the results, as you will hear, are kind of banal, in my opinion. Yeah, they're all kind of easily agreeable with, but those answers sound to me like those of an Anglo-Saxon, economically privileged, urban-residing, Netflix-watching farmer's market shopper. Or maybe like someone who's trying to give a food podcaster what seems like the so-called right answers. In any case, to my ear, it's a good indication of the algorithms and baked-in systemic biases that a lot of folks are fearful about when it comes to AI and generative AI. Is it all going to converge on a kind of bland, Soylent-like acceptability? Correct, but not that interesting? Smooth, to the point of being just textureless? Well, you decide. ChatGPT at this point needs little introduction to most podcast listeners, but for the sake of providing a bio, here you go. ChatGPT is an AI language model designed to assist users with a wide range of tasks and inquiries created by OpenAI. Trained on vast datasets, it strives to provide helpful and informative responses to support and enhance human interactions and productivity. And yes, that is ChatGPT's bio as written by ChatGPT itself. I edited the text to the third-person voice. ChatGPT, what is your idea of a perfect food?
The perfect food, in my opinion, is sushi. I love the combination of flavors and textures in each bite, the freshness of the fish, the creaminess of the avocado, and the subtle crunch of the rice. It's not just a dish, it's a culinary experience that engages all the senses. The artistry involved in sushi preparation and the attention to detail make it a delightful and satisfying choice for me.
Of what food or food context are you afraid or distrustful?
I'm a bit wary of extremely spicy foods. While I appreciate some heat, overly spicy dishes can overpower the flavors and leave me reaching for water rather than savoring the taste.
What word or concept describes a well-balanced food system?
Sustainability.
What word or concept describes why food systems often remain unbalanced?
Inequality.
Which food person do you most admire?
Anthony Bourdain. Bourdain's fearless exploration of diverse cuisines and cultures, combined with his candid storytelling, made him a captivating figure. His approach to food went beyond the plate, emphasizing the connections between people and their culinary traditions. He inspired a genuine appreciation for global food diversity and fostered a sense of shared humanity through the universal language of food.
Which food innovation do you try to ignore?
Lab-grown meat.
What is your greatest gastronomic extravagance?
Truffle-infused dishes.
For what do you hunger?
Culinary adventures.
What do you consider to be an overrated food or food context?
Fancy avocado toast.
On what occasion do you feign satiety?
When presented with a homemade dish that, despite being less appealing, I appreciate due to the effort and thoughtfulness behind it.
What do you most dislike about dinner tables?
Forced small talk.
What is the quality you most like in a fruit?
Juiciness.
What is the quality you most like in a cut of meat?
Tenderness.
Which condiments do you most overuse?
Hot sauce and sriracha.
What kinds of gardens make you happiest?
Herb gardens.
Which culinary skill would you most like to have?
Mastering the art of pastry.
If you could change one thing about nutrition, what would it be?
More accessible and affordable healthy food options for everyone.
What do you consider your greatest edible achievement?
Perfecting a family recipe for a signature dish.
If you were to die and come back as an edible animal, vegetable, or mineral, what would it be?
An olive tree.
Where and or when would you most like to dine?
A traditional Japanese ryokan overlooking cherry blossoms in full bloom during spring.
What is your most treasured kitchen implement?
A well-seasoned cast iron skillet.
What is your favorite highly processed food?
Dark chocolate covered almonds.
What is your favorite aroma?
Freshly baked bread.
What spice, kitchen implement, or cookbook do you use most rarely?
Saffron.
What do you most value in your friend's food?
Creativity and a willingness to experiment with flavors.
Who are your favorite food writers?
Michael Pollan and Ruth Reichel.
Who are your favorite food celebrities?
Gordon Ramsay and Nigella Lawson.
With which cuisine do you most identify?
Mediterranean.
What is your most powerful sense?
Taste.
What are your favorite agricultural, culinary, or gastronomic words?
Umami, for its unique and savory essence.
What would you eat as your second-to-last meal?
A multi-course sushi omakase.
What food-related epitaph would you put on your own tombstone?
Savored every bite, left no flavor unexplored.
What question would you either add to this questionnaire or like to ask me?
If you could share a meal with any historical figure, who would it be and what dish would you serve them?
So that wraps up this media and tech episode of Making a Meal of It. Thank you big time to Sina Russo, Maz Gardezi, and Maxim Juhu. Acknowledgements to ChatGPT and the developers of OpenAI, who have given us much to think about and perhaps be fearful of. I'm also grateful to Frederick Pohl and Cyril Kornbluth for helping me remember that science fiction is always social fiction, and to the echoes of the voices of the reboot of Battlestar Galactica. All this has happened before. All of this will happen again. As usual, many thanks to Ben and Nick at Story Mode, who designed and produced the show's music and sounds digitally, but with much analog heart. Go to storymode.ca for more info. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us so that others can discover the show wherever you and they listen to podcasts. Next week, we leave the digital world behind in favor of the very real spaces of kitchens, including the ways they encourage us to dance, play, love, and generate sensory goodness through our own very natural intelligences. Join us, won't you? In the meantime, as so many have said before, Dobro shut and Bilhanova shifa.